Fantasy Basketball Podcast. My name is Josh Lloyd, and today I'm joined by Daniel LaRue. Danny, how are you going?
Doing well. How are you?
Very, very good. It's good to have you on. Now, before we get everything started, Daniel is works at Real GM. You can find his work on Sporting News. He's also the host of the Real GM Radio Podcast and a frequent co-host of the Dunked On Podcast, part of the Real GM Network as well. Danny, where can everyone find you on Twitter?
My Twitter handle is Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux.
Now, those podcasts you're doing, they're fantastic. And if anybody doesn't listen to them and subscribe to those podcasts, I do recommend that everybody does that. And you said you've got a couple episodes coming this week for both shows?
Yes, I should have a couple of each, yeah.
All right, so that's good. So make sure you're checking out what Danny's doing across over on those podcasts. There are a lot of fantastic stuff that him and Nate and all his other guests are doing on those shows. But today, Danny, I thought I'd get you on to this podcast because we hear a lot of people talk about the off season, the draft, free agency, all that sort of stuff, and who the big winners are. I want to cover the guys who are not losers, because it's not a very nice term, but the guys who lost out, players on existing teams whose minutes are going to be crunched, whose roles are going to be reduced, who may not see quite the level of production that they saw last season. So that's what we're going to look at here and talk about, you know, what opportunity these guys might have and how far they how much they're going to be restricted. Now, it feels like the NBA talent pool spread out a little bit across the offseason. There was most of the guys that moved to situations that bettered them, but there's always people who are going to lose out. Now, the first one I want to talk about, which is one that's always, not always, but it's got me baffled quite a bit, is the Celtics front court. All right, so they brought in Amir Johnson. They traded for David Lee, and they also re-signed Jonas Jerebko. But what happens to the two incumbent guys there, Jared Sullinger and Kelly Olynyk? How do you see this playing out with this front court rotation and the starting bigs?
Yeah, it's really complicated. I mean, I think Amir Johnson, especially considering they're paying him $12 million a year, I think that he's going to get a heavy part of that. But Brad Stevens is somebody, I think, who's going to try to balance it. And what I'm intrigued on is whether they're going to keep set pairings or whether they're going to bounce it around a little bit. For sure, at the beginning of the season, they will, just because you need to figure out who works with each other. But, you know, maybe they end up with Olynyk and Amir. Maybe they end up with Sullinger and Amir, however they do that. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, and not only that, but when they signed him or when they agreed to terms, I thought Jay Crowder made the most sense for them as a power forward, as a four. I like him better in that role just in terms of offensively. And there are no power forward minutes left for him. So he'll be fine at the three. I mean, he can do that. He can do that job, especially considering they have so comparatively little talent there. But yeah, it's going to be tough. I think from a fantasy perspective, I think all those guys lose out, even in the case of injury, because they're so deep that they can soak up those minutes and still not play anybody that much.
Yeah, that's right, because as you said, they can shift Crowder across to the four, because what they were doing last year is they were playing Evan Turner at the three a lot, and you know, he's still going to get minutes because Brad Stevens obviously liked what Turner was doing. He was handling the ball a lot, and it's not like there's a ton of minutes at guard either. They brought in two new guards with Rozier and RJ Hunter as well. It just feels like, I've mentioned this before, feels like there's 12, 13 guys who are all deserving of 20 to 25 minutes, and you can't say, okay, this guy shouldn't get minutes, this guy shouldn't get minutes. It's Smart, Isaiah Thomas, Evan Turner, Crowder. You're going to give Rozier some minutes. Those four or five big guys there as well. There's just a lot of players, and it feels like everybody is going to take a hit in terms of what their numbers are going to be like. David Lee, someone that I am interested in. Do you think that he, now you follow the Warriors pretty closely, he lost his job last season to Draymond Green. I don't think that was injury related. Do you think that he is done as a big time, big stats sort of guy? Is he really on the decline, or was that just an odd sort of situation for him last season?
I think that he would have to be on a pretty poor team in order to get a lot of stats, but he is still a useful guy. And if you're not asking him to protect the rim, he's somebody who coaches can like a lot, because he rebounds reasonably well. He's a great passer, and he has become a lot more unselfish recently in his career, especially when he plays with good players. So he is the type of guy, this happened with Mark Jackson, where some coaches like him as a safety blanket. The problem for him in terms of the Celtics is they have a lot of those guys. You know, this is a group that, depending on who Brad Stevens likes, and he's coming into a situation where the coaches know everybody better than they know him, except for Amir, because everybody else has already been there. So I think there's a possibility And what you look at for him in terms of like a fantasy perspective is he will have big games. So let's say, you know, Jared Sullinger twists his ankle. So he's not going to be out, you know, for weeks or anything. He's just going to maybe be limited for a game. Maybe Lee takes those minutes and has a really nice game. I think that's what's going to happen with somebody like him. So maybe in more of a daily setup, or maybe in more of a situation where you're streaming guys, he could still have value there.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the key. It's going to be, let's see what's happening for this week or this couple of weeks, and let's get Sullinger in, let's get Lee in. Yeah, maybe that these guys are sitting and they're running with Jarepko for 25 minutes a night for a week or so, which is something that we saw it happen last season when he'd get big run at times. And yeah, Olynyk will play, then he'll play 5 minutes one night. It's going to be really hard to predict on a season-long, long-term basis, but you've got to play the matchups as they happen and as the situations occur. Now, another guy in Charlotte, Cody Zeller, he had a massive opportunity last season, but for whatever reason, he wasn't able to take hold of that. Marvin Williams was getting more minutes than him even when Zeller moved into the starting lineup. But now they have drafted Frank Kaminsky. They've acquired Spencer Hawes. Does this show a lack of faith in Zeller? Does he have any chance to get the minutes here? Or who do you project starting out of those four guys?
I think Zeller probably starts, but it's going to be a pretty open competition for it. Kaminsky, I mean, if you heard the reports about what the Celtics offered to get him, they passed up a lot to keep him. So that means you have a commitment there. Hawes is a good player who had a really bad season. I mean, you could see a parallel to Jared Dudley in the sense of he was put in a bad spot and he didn't thrive in that bad spot. But I could see Steve Clifford really enjoying his just capability there. But why it's Zeller's job to lose is that he has the combination of potential and comfort with the system. I mean, so I think Kaminsky's going to come on a little bit. Obviously, he had a long college career, so this isn't a 19-year-old like Vonleh coming in there. But I think it's Zeller's job to lose now, but he could still lose it, just like he did last year, as you said, with Marvin, who's still on the roster too.
Yeah, there's a number of guys. And again, I like Zeller probably the best out of those players as well. I just was hoping that he was going to be able to get the big minutes last year and start putting in the production. And at times he would do it, but he just wouldn't do it consistently enough. And it felt like that Clifford had, you know, a relatively short leash with him. And if you saw him not performing, then Williams would go out there and play 28, 29 minutes and Zeller would be restricted. And that's going to make pretty much all these guys really hard to own for fantasy purposes, I think. Now, a guy that is an interesting player for me to look at, Danny, is Timofey Mozgov. Now, he only played 25 minutes a game when he was in Cleveland. He played 26 minutes a game when he was in Denver. And at a lot of times he was preferred, or no, he was preferred, Tristan Thompson was preferred over him off the bench. So they'd start Mozgov and then Thompson would come in and play 30 minutes. Now, there's a player that a lot of people have forgotten about that he's going to come back, and that's Anderson Varejao. Now, he's coming back from an Achilles injury. We know how injury prone he is, but he's going to get some minutes. Does Thompson lose minutes? Does Mozgov lose minutes? Who do you think takes the biggest hit from, even if Varejao plays 10 or 12 minutes, that's 10 or 12 minutes that somebody's not going to play. And it's not going to be Kevin Love, I don't think. Who do you think loses out?
I think it's a little bit of Mozgov and a little bit of Thompson. Varejao is pretty clearly the fourth guy in the totem pole. But one thing that's really important there is we've talked about, you know, like how LeBron James is such a large figure in that organization. And the reason Varejao is still there is because LeBron wants him there. And so he is, in my opinion, more of the injury replacement. But yeah, I think he's going to take a couple minutes away from Mozgov and a couple minutes away from Thompson in the regular season. And then the playoffs, you can largely squeeze him out if the other guys are healthy. Why I find Varejao interesting in this is also in terms of all these guys is that they have what I like to call scalability, which is that all of these guys can step up their minutes if somebody gets hurt. So if that's, you know, if that's Mozgov, then Thompson and Love and all those guys. I mean, Love's played 30 plus minutes a lot. Thompson can. I think he did 1 year for the Cavs. So those guys are exciting because if somebody gets hurt, and the odds are, especially considering what's happened with that front court rotation, somebody will, the other people's value for that temporary basis will improve dramatically because they've already shown the capability of doing
it. Yeah, exactly. It's great for them. It's great for the Cavs in terms of the depth and having those different options of what they can do. And if they decide they want to rest a guy here or there, depending on what's happening with the season, they've got other players there. And the return of Varejao does strengthen that. But it makes me worry a little bit about Mozgov for the fantasy value because he was only getting 25 minutes a game. If he loses another 2 minutes, even if it's only 2 minutes, but down to 23, that's not a huge amount of minutes to have an impact in a smallish size fantasy league when there's going to be other guys out there who are getting 30, 32 minutes. And it's just, it, it does limit him. Now, he can put up big numbers, but on an average sort of basis, the, if the minutes reduce, then his numbers will reduce a little bit as well.
Absolutely.
Now, Marcus Morris had a nice stretch last season in Phoenix. He was playing a bit of stretch four when they were having some injuries. He was traded across to Detroit. And at this point, I would say that he is the starter. Would you agree with that?
I think Ilyasova is probably the starter right now, but it's wide open between those two guys. I mean, Stan Van Gundy hasn't really played, really had either of those guys on roster, so you don't really know what his preference is. I like Ilyasova better personally. I think he was so very underrated and underutilized, but it's a real coin flip right now.
And what about at the three, though? I've heard that they're going to go with Morris at the three and play Stanley Johnson off the bench.
Yep. If they can use him at the three, that makes some sense. They have I think Stanley Johnson will play well enough that he will, even if he doesn't necessarily starting there, he will become the starter eventually. But really, a lot of people think about minutes in terms of starters and non-starters. I think that with that team, at least in the beginning, the number of minutes is far more important than who gets the nominal start, except for the ancillary. And I mean, from a rebounding perspective, you talk about how the stats matter. Playing with somebody that isn't Andre Drummond might actually help for that, because that opens it up a little bit, because Drummond is such a monstrous rebounder.
Yeah, that's right. Drummond's going to go out there and grab 14 boards a game probably. And then when his backups come in, there's not that much rebounding prowess amongst the other Detroit big men. So yeah, he'll be able to shift over. Like even when Ilyasova's off, he can shift over and play the four and get his rebound numbers up as well. So he's in a situation where he might decrease from what he was doing at the end of last season, but his overall production might actually go up depending on how they run their rotation. Now, Ty Lawson's probably one of the biggest losers of the offseason, and that's nothing personal against him, but he's going from a situation where he was on a talent-poor team in Denver. He had the ball in his hand all the time. He almost averaged 10 assists a game. It wasn't necessarily his best season, but he was able to put up some fantasy stats. Now he heads across to Houston, and we know that there's another guy there who's going to have the ball in his hands quite a bit in James Harden. Now, I think with Ty Lawson, I've been saying this for a bit, ever since he got traded, I think he's better running off the bench for them. Beverly fits better next to Harden, and I can't see Lawson even approaching anything close to what he did last season. I think that he'll get limited minutes. Look, Beverly might only play 28 minutes, but I think that Lawson might only play a similar number. Do you see them running him and Harden together more, or how do you see Lawson's role figuring now in Houston?
I think their best five involves Lawson playing, but you really hurt Beverly's value by playing him without Harden, because he still obviously could get better, but he's not totally capable of being the man running an offense. And he has a lot of value as a point guard who doesn't do that because he plays so good defensively. And when you have Harden on the floor, you don't need that traditional primary ball handler. But the point with why I made the point about their best five being Lawson at the start, most teams end up gravitating towards that over the course of the season. I think in a lot of ways that's the justification for what happened with Draymond Green eventually with the Warriors. What happened at the start of the year was that Coach Kerr realized their best five was involving that. And so if you build your team around that to a point that you want those guys to close. And I think while Lawson's total stats will probably be down, and maybe down precipitously because he has their talent, his efficiency stats will probably be substantially better because he's going to get much better looks. And for leagues that count turnovers, his turnovers are probably going to be down significantly because he's going to have the ball in his hands less. So I think what he will bring is he will be a less valuable player from game to game, but he will do less that hurts you. So depending on where you are in it, and that's another situation where injuries can play a major factor, because I think that at some point one of those two guys with Lawson and Beverly is going to get hurt. The other one's going to have a real chance to show themselves. But I'm excited to see also if they use the two Lawson and Beverly together, because that could be intriguing as well, because that uses Lawson's strengths a little bit as a handler, and Beverly can be more of an off the ball defender. So he can do kind of what he's going to do. But it's hard to predict with the Rock, because that's another situation where, as you said, it's always hard to separate guys who've started together before. So even though Lawson is better and they're paying him more money and all that, he wasn't the starter there last year. Patrick Beverly was, and this was a team that when they had him on the floor was a very good basketball team. So I always default to that when you have that out there. But at the same time, Ty Lawson is a really good basketball player. So I think that he will have the opportunity to get his minutes. But I'm, yeah, it's exciting.
With Beverly, like he did basically exactly what they wanted him to do. They don't need him to go out there and run things and distribute the ball. Harden is basically the point guard, and he runs that team. Beverly goes out there and he sits outside. He hits threes, and then he goes and plays tenacious defense. Basically, the whole game. You know, picks up guys full court. That's what he does. Now Ty Lawson can't do that. He's not a knockdown shooter or anything like that. But he can get better in that role, and maybe with Harden just drawing all of the attention as he drives into the lane, that opens up Lawson for more open shots, and maybe that helps him. But his numbers are definitely going to take a dip, but it doesn't mean you need to avoid him altogether when you're looking at drafting guys. In Indiana, a trio of guys, I think, take a hit. Rodney Stuckey, Solomon Hill, and CJ Miles, who all at times put up pretty good numbers. CJ Miles was red hot down the stretch. Rodney Stuckey had an insane stretch throughout January, February, where he was hitting basically as many threes in that month that he had in the previous season. Solomon Hill started basically all of the season, didn't necessarily put up a huge amount of numbers, but he was active and he was a good defender. But now they get the return of Paul George. Monte Ellis comes in as well. So all these guys are gonna take a significant hit, I think. There's no way around that, is there, Danny?
No, there isn't. I think that these guys are some of the biggest losers in fantasy just because their minutes are going away and their roles are going to change. Because one of the things that I always think about with it is not only are these guys transitioning to be bench players, but they're going to be surrounded by less talented guys. So that means that some of their per minute stats will go up. They'll get more shots, but they'll probably be less efficient and they will get a lot less opportunity. So I think that in particular, Stuckey is going to be hurt by this. And what makes Indiana so unusual is that they got deeper in that area, but they got so much shallower in the front court. So you have this possibility that they move Paul George to power forward a little bit, and that would open up some minutes presumably for Solomon Hill. But you can't, like, let's say particularly in a draft situation, you can't plan on that unless we hear something more substantive on it before then, because Paul George apparently is more comfortable playing the three. That makes sense. It's what he's done his whole career. I mean, other than when he's with Granger, but those are nominal distinctions. So it's always hard to tell a star player that he's going to do something different. So until I see it on the court, I'm not going to assume it.
And even if you're right with in terms of the front court, but Solomon Hill could also play some backup 4 minutes as well, because it's not like they have guys who are locked in and demanding big minutes in that front court. Jamal Crawford for the Clippers, we know that what he does, he comes off the bench and he's a scorer. And that's great because the Clippers had nobody on their bench last year, but they bring in a few other guys onto the bench this year. Lance Stevenson arrives, Josh Smith arrives, who at this stage will probably be on the bench. You'd think Paul Pierce would start. Is that going to impact Crawford's use of having the ball in his hands, especially with Stevenson there and Smith to a degree? Is that going to reduce what Crawford, and he's another year older, does that reduce Crawford's output?
Substantially, yeah. And not only that, but I would mention Austin Rivers, because not only is he the coach's son, but he's comfortable having the ball in his hands too. So you're creating a lineup that is going to be very fun. I think that those guys have some fascinating combinations of skills. But in terms of stats, it'll probably hurt all of them, because you have a lot of guys. Because when you have the ball in your hands, especially if you're Lance Stevenson, you're going to take some shots. And Crawford is, I love him in the role of being the guy offensively on a second unit. And it's possible that the Clippers are going to do some things in terms of moving those guys around. But the problem is, when the starters have Chris Paul, you don't necessarily want a second guy who wants the ball in their hands all the time, because Chris Paul is the alpha and the omega in terms of that offense. I mean, Blake, they have the ecosystem with the two of them, but you don't want to really put Chris with Lance Stevenson that much, because Chris might go insane. So I think that you want to put those guys away from your stars to that point, though they're all really good players. I mean, it's not a criticism of them. It's just you have to think about the balance of players. And so I think that means it hurts all of them, though it helps the team. And that's why in some ways fantasy is interesting, because the Clippers made themselves better, but they hurt all these guys' value.
Yeah, so all of those guys, Crawford, Stevenson, and Smith, it's going to be really hard to get them anywhere or draft them anywhere inside the top 100. They're like, I'm going to take a risk in my last pick and maybe something works out. But to me, all of them, who, you know, Stevenson 2 years ago was a staple in teams. Josh Smith has been a top 20 guy at points in his career. Crawford's been a top 70, top 60 sort of guy. But they're all going to take a hit. Shifting to the other LA team, Jordan Clarkson was amazing down the stretch last year. But a lot of that comes from the fact that he was the only guy there, basically. They had nobody else. No other point guards. Ronnie Price was out. Jeremy Lin wasn't playing. Kobe Bryant was out. So Clarkson had the ball in his hands. He was doing basically everything from this team. Now he's just been flooded with other guards. D'Angelo Russell comes in. Kobe returns. Lou Williams comes back. Nick Young comes back. Clarkson was very impressive. We saw him out at Summer League, Danny, and he was impressive there as well. But with all these other guys there, it's going to be hard for him to live up to what he did in the second half of last season. Do you agree, or do you think he takes over?
I think that you run into a similar challenge as what we just talked about with the Clippers in terms of the guys who like the ball in their hands, except for the Lakers, it's their whole team.
Yep.
And that makes it even harder because then you can't really figure out a role. I like Clarkson. I think that he got overrated in the sense that his counting stats were really good, but guys do that on bad teams all the time, you know, but he is a very talented player and he's getting better at using his physical advantages, which is very important. And that's what you see from a talented guy and from his first year to his second year. And that's what he did in Summer League. He was a guy who probably shouldn't have been in Summer League because he was so much better than the guys that were around him. But I can see a role for him on this Lakers team if they play him with the second unit. But again, if you play him primarily with the second unit, then because then he can be that guy there, depending on how they want to do it. I mean, I think Kobe's going to play a lot of small forward.
I think
he has to. And so if you bounce it around, I can see Clarkson getting minutes. The other component was something we talked about in terms of, you know, playing the guys, you know, is Clarkson did really well in this team last year. They kept the same coach.
Yep.
So I think they have an expectation and they know this guy can deliver. So he's going to get a chance. The other player that I would talk about, and it's strange to think about this affecting Clarkson, is Julius Randle, because Randle is in a position where I think they feel pressure themselves to make sure that he gets his. And whether that's is as a starter, or I actually think he's going to primarily play on the second unit. I think they're going to, my theory with the Lakers, and so it's just a theory right now, preseason, is that they're going to play Bass, Kobe, and Hibbert together more and just kind of be more in that slower identity and then have another group of players that are more up-tempo. And but what that does for Randle is that means that he's going to get his. And so if Clarkson's playing in that group, it could limit him a little bit more, because when you throw it in the big man, you can get assists, but a lot of times you don't get a lot of the other ancillary benefits that you get as a perimeter player.
Yeah, I agree that Randle is going to play in that second unit. I can't see Byron Scott running him out there over Brandon Bass as a more dependable veteran. Scott isn't someone who's necessarily going to be planning for the future. He doesn't seem like to me he's going to be that sort of coach who is you know, let's do what's best for the future of this team. He's just going to want to get guys out there that he can rely upon. And I think he's going to be able to rely upon Brandon Bass, because Randle missed all of his rookie season. He wasn't overly impressive in Summer League either. And I think that to me he's, I don't know. It's just, it feels like there's parts missing from his game, which can develop, but I don't think that Scott is going to want to get him out there as much as what a lot of people would hope. Now, in Milwaukee, Danny, there's a couple of guys who I am interested in. Michael Carter-Williams came across. He struggled a bit as a starter. Obviously, coming to a better team than when he was in Philadelphia, his counting stats all dropped. He did improve his efficiency, which is something that I think a few people have missed, that he was able to get his field goal percentage up by about 3 or 4%. His free throws climbed up over 70%, which is big for him considering how bad all those numbers were in Philadelphia. But a few of his other numbers decreased, and the Bucks weren't as good with him there. Now, they did a trade to bring in Grievous Vasquez from Toronto, and there has been some talk of people thinking, well, maybe Vasquez is going to take some minutes off Carter Williams. Maybe he could be the starter. I still think that it's Carter Williams, and I still think the kid really is enamored with Carter Williams and thinks that he can work with him quite well. Do you see a risk there with Vasquez?
There's a small risk, but what you have to think about with that is that the Bucks had the opportunity basically to get that crazy value Lakers pick, and they chose Michael Carter-Williams over that. So that means you have to think highly of him. And while he disappointed to a degree in that stretch after the deadline, I don't think he was so different from what they expected, and the Bucks did very well as a team. So I think kid's going to stick with him primarily, but Vasquez is the type of guy, we've talked about this with a few guys, that coaches would really like. He's steady. He's unselfish. But what I think will help Michael Carter-Williams maybe more than anything is the increase in offensive talent of their first unit. And primarily that's Greg Monroe. Greg Monroe is a great passer. So I think that some of Carter-Williams's, you know, his counting stats. His counting stats are going to take a hit because Philadelphia is the, you know, it's the fool's gold of counting stats. I mean, if that's what you want, like, you should go after those guys all the time. But his efficiency stats could do pretty well. And another guy on this team that I'm just having trouble figuring out his role, I understand why they like him, is John Henson.
Yep.
And Henson is very talented, and he fits in well with the other players they have. I like him next to Greg Monroe. I think he's intriguing next to Jabari Parker and Giannis, depending on how they want to move everything around there. But there are only so many minutes to go around. And the big question in some ways with Milwaukee is, do they want to play bigger? Do they want to play smaller? Like, how are they going to take all of these players that they really like and build a team where they all get the minutes they deserve? And I think they will, but that's hard. You know, like most teams, when they think about it, you know, you have the starters who get starter minutes and the backups who don't. But if you're presumably Jabari, Giannis, and Monroe are going to start, how are they going to reconcile that with getting Henson what he deserves? And I think they will do it, but it takes time.
Well, Henson last season, even with only Zaza Pachulia there, only played 18 minutes a game. And to me, that's a red flag in terms of what he's going to do this year, because he had the opportunity. There was times last year when they had nobody in the front court. They were starting Johnny O'Brien, and Henson was their only other big man with any talent. Not that O'Brien is good, but O'Brien had to start. Henson would play, and he still wouldn't play more than 24 minutes. And it didn't make any sense to me, apart from the fact that I thought, okay, kid just doesn't necessarily like this guy out there for long stretches of time. And for him to, look, he averaged 2 blocks a game in 18 minutes, which is fantastic. You know, per 36, 4 blocks a game is almost leading the league. But he's just not getting... He had an opportunity to get big minutes, and when a guy has an opportunity and it's approaching and he doesn't get it, that makes me think, you know, that's not a good sign for him, especially now that they bring in Greg Monroe, who's going to play 33 minutes or something along those lines. And where is Henson in a position to get more minutes than what he got last year when there was a lot of nothingness around him? That's what I worry about with him. But he's a great guy to stream in. If you want a block in a game, like at the end of a matchup, I need a block, John Henson comes in, he's going to get you a block even if he plays 15 minutes. There's going to be a block there, there's going to be 5 or 6 rebounds, but the overall production is going to be limited by that fact of, I just don't think he's going to get minutes.
Yeah, I was surprised by the possibility, the rumors that he's going to get an extension, because if he gets an extension now, then that means the Bucks are committing to him in a very different way. And maybe that would, because that reporting, while it hasn't come to fruition yet, which is also interesting, it's always weird, like with Tristan Thompson, when you hear that there's like an agreement or they're close to an agreement, and it's not, and then weeks go by and it doesn't happen. But I think that they like him, and that's always useful. You know, when a front office really likes a guy or a coach really likes a guy and you see that manifest itself, then that's when I think it might follow. But you're right that he had the opportunity and take it. So for me, that takes precedence. So, but with a guy like Henson, you might be able to wait until there are some signs and then jump on him, because I don't think he's high enough on anybody's list that he's going to be, you know, that I think people lose patience with him, and he might even be on the wire eventually.
Yeah, that I would say that's definitely the case. In Minnesota, Gorgui Dieng has been fantastic the last couple of seasons when he's been forced into action when Nikola Pekovic goes down with his annual injury. But now they brought in Kevin Garnett late last season. They obviously draft Karl-Anthony Towns with the first pick this year. They bring in a guy whose name that I struggle to pronounce, Nemanja Bjelica. How do you pronounce it?
I say it Nemanja Bjelica.
Okay.
I'm more confident in the last name than the first name, but yeah, Bjelica, and he's a monster. I mean, he was MVP last year.
Yeah, he was.
He's a really talented player. But yeah, I mean, Minnesota's front court, we talked about Boston. I think in a way, Minnesota's is even harder because they have Karl-Anthony Towns, who is their future at the big man positions, whatever his role is, you do that. They have Pekovic, who's been extremely productive when he's been healthy. Dieng has done well. They have not only Kevin Garnett, who basically will get whatever minutes he wants because he's Kevin Garnett and they just paid him a bunch of money. He's a veteran mentor. But they also have, for now at least, Anthony Bennett, who is still an intriguing talent. And what is hard for them, both from a fantasy perspective and just from a functional perspective, is how do those guys fit together? I mean, there are a lot of them that I like. I like just about all those players. I like Bjelica. I like Karl-Anthony Towns. I like Kevin Garnett, obviously. I've liked Gorgui Dieng forever. But who fits with who, and how is Flip Saunders going to manage that? And does he want, you know, my first thought when they drafted Towns and re-signed Garnett was, oh, that's going to be their starting front court. But at the same time, who knows? You know, they Pekovic, they paid him a ton of money. And so their uncertainty is kind of all those pieces at the same time. And also, there's a whole issue with their identity, because when you have Ricky Rubio, you should run. But half of their big men don't make sense in an up-tempo offense right now. So what do they want to do? How do they define themselves? A lot of that comes from the personality of the coach. And that would scare me off of, in a single season league, would scare me off of almost everybody in their front court rotation, just because it's so uncertain.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like that to me, as soon as Towns was drafted there, I was like, okay, that's great. He's got fantastic ability. He could be a guy like Anthony Davis in 2 or 3 years' time, but it's going to be hard for him to get over 25 minutes a game, especially to start the season with just so many other. Like Garnett's going to get 18 minutes a game every second game. Like he's going to rest, we know that. But all these other guys, plus a guy we didn't even mention then, Danny Shabazz Muhammad, he played a lot of four last year as well. And he.
I think he'll play three mostly, but I like Shabazz a lot. And also, when you think about just the geometry of their team, they have a couple of wings that they like to post up. Yep. And that's Andrew Wiggins and Shabazz Muhammad. And that changes it too. Like, I mean, you can't really play it back to the basket post game with Pekovic there, because Pekovic's guy isn't going to respect his jump shot. You know, Pekovic's guy is going to be hanging there. So how they piece together their rotation, I think they have the hardest rotation to figure out in the whole league. Honestly,
yeah,
and I like all their guys,
weird.
But it's crazy.
Yeah, look, and Wiggins and Muhammad don't go and hit threes either, so they have to play closer in. So they don't have many guys who are going to go out and stretch the floor. It's definitely a little bit weird. And they just I don't know. It's very confusing a lot of what they do. And they just traded for Damian Rudez. Now he's not a big piece, but he's a guy who can play at the four and hit threes, and he did. He hit these threes at a pretty high clip last year in Indiana, so it's pretty weird what they're doing, and it's gonna be. I can't wait to watch them, but it scares me, as you said, it scares me off all of their guys for their fantasy value.
Yeah,
in Oklahoma City, the return of Kevin Durant's gonna affect a lot of stuff. They just signed Enes Kanter to a max deal. Now he was putting up, you know, career best numbers, and we're talking numbers of, you know, top 20 fantasy value down the stretch last year when he was going 20 and 10 basically every single game. We've heard the story. I spoke with Mika Honkasalo from Nylon Calculus last week about how bad his defense is. We know that. But for fantasy, he was putting up insane numbers. Now, he's going to take a hit in terms of touches. Do you see him being the starter next to Ibaka? Does Adams get that job? What sort of minutes do you think we're looking at with Kanter? He still should get the 30 minutes, correct?
I think he'll still get plenty of minutes, and I think he'll start. As you know, having guys who are ahead of you on the offensive totem pole, even for a big man who thrives as an offensive rebounder, it can be hard to get your stats at the same level, because you're not going to get touches in the same way. There were stretches during that when Durant was out that they could basically just say, hey, if we're sputtering, we can just throw Kanter the ball and he's going to do that. They're not going to sputter a whole heck of a lot with Kevin Durant, because you have Kevin Durant. He's maybe arguably the best offensive player in the league, and you pair both of them better offensively. But Kanter is still a dominant offensive rebounder. He's still a great fantasy guy. As much as I personally dislike his game and dislike him from a basketball perspective, all of that stuff doesn't matter for fantasy. It doesn't matter if I like him. The only way that that downside manifests itself is if the coaches get frustrated and play him less minutes. And there's a possibility of that, but they just gave him a ton of money. And he is talented, and the reasons that they acquired him, as much as I disagreed with him, are still there. So the only weakness for him in that sense is that they have a new coach, and Billy Donovan's going to, you know, he's going to have his own ethos on everything else. And I mean, his most successful college teams had strong defensive centers, Joakim Noah being the headliner. I mean, they had Al Horford, who's a good defensive center, as their four, which is ridiculous. So there is a possibility there that they'll go in the option. But if they move Kanter to the bench, with the way Oklahoma City's bench is structured, unless Donovan is willing to separate, stagger Westbrook and Durant more than Scottie Brooks was, which he should, is if Kanter plays more with the second unit, he'll get a ton of touches. Yep. And so I think he'll do fine either way from a fantasy perspective. I mean, I don't think anybody should expect him to reach his highs from last year, but I think that was true regardless. I mean, he was getting, you know, an aberration in terms of touches and all that, but he's still a very talented fantasy guy. I mean, for the same reasons we talked about. I mean, he's going to get his minutes, he's going to get his touches, and it'll just change. It'll, his role and what his value is will change a little bit based on where he is, but I think he's still worth taking pretty high either way, because they made a commitment to him. And when you make a commitment to a guy, it's awfully hard to step off it that year.
Well, not that quickly anyway. They might, you know, run it for 6 months and then say, okay, maybe not, but they're going to give him every opportunity. So there is risk there, but I think it's a calculated risk in terms of if you're looking to get him, he's still going to get a fair amount of offense there. In Orlando, a guy that I probably have inexplicable affection for, Evan Fournier, is a guy who's probably going... Look, he started a big chunk last year when Victor Oladipo was out, and he had a stretch through November where he was putting up really good numbers. But Oladipo, Alfred Payton, Tobias Harris, now Mario Hezonja's back, Aaron Gordon's going to play, and he wants to play some three as well. Fournier feels like the odd man out there. He's coming up for restricted free agency next summer, so he's going to have motivation to get himself a big payday, but I just can't see him getting minutes in that rotation. Are you a fan of Fournier? Probably not to the same level I am, because I don't think anyone is, but what do you see for him?
I like him a lot. I'm a big supporter of big guards who can pass. It's just one of my weaknesses, and Evan Fournier certainly fits that bill. I liked him as a draft prospect. I still like him now. But as you said, there are a lot of guys that are ahead of him. And I mean, you start at the top, and I think of Fournier more as a two, and Oladipo and Payton are their backcourt. You know, whether anybody likes it or not, that's their backcourt. And as you mentioned, the other spillover guy here is Tobias Harris, because Tobias Harris is going to get minutes, and Aaron Gordon is going to get minutes. And I mean, I think Hezonja could be squeezed out to a point too, but what Fournier has to do is he's competing not only for a smaller piece of the pie, but he's competing with more people for it. So yeah, from a fantasy perspective, that's going to be really tough, because it's exceedingly unlikely that he starts, except, you know, barring injury. Mm-hmm. And so that means you're playing with the second unit. That means you're, you know, CJ Watson's your point guard, which is fine. You know, I like CJ Watson a lot, but it's a little bit harder to do it. He's not going to have the ball in his hands as much because they have a guy they trust there. And so, yeah, I think he's a big loser. And Orlando has so much kind of weird talent that I'm not sure their situations resolve themselves quickly, you know, unless they make a trade, like unless they sign Tobias Harris with the idea that maybe they're going to trade him. Because, I mean, you talk about all these guys, and then you remember they also paid Channing Frye a lot of money last year. And so how do you the way that they reconcile their situation is through a trade, but I have no idea who they trade, you know, so that's hard for all those guys. And if you want to take a guy, let's say like a Tobias Harris or an Evan Fournier, with the idea that, oh, maybe they'll go somewhere else, you have no idea what that value is going to be either. So it's hard. It's hard to calibrate with them. The guys who I think about that are probably going to get the minutes for them are the guys they've made the greatest commitments to. That's always the assumption I use. So that goes to Payton, Oladipo, Tobias Harris, and Aaron Gordon, with Hezonja being kind of the next guy, and obviously Vucevic, but he's his own thing. Yep. And so, yeah, but if you're not in that group, you're probably going to get squeezed out.
Agreed. Now, talking about other point guards, in Sacramento, Darren Collison had a season probably better than a lot of people anticipated. I'd say most people. He was not only serviceable, he was good. He was part of, you know, Sacramento's mini big three, along with Rudy Gay and DeMarcus Cousins, and he was putting up great numbers, and he was a really surprising fantasy guy. He was a top 50 sort of player last year before he went down with that hip injury. Now they bring in Rajon Rondo, who you'd think is going to be the starter, even though he was absolutely horrific last season. You would think that he's going to get the position over Collison and going to get the bulk of the minutes there. And then you think, okay, Collison can move to the two, which he did when he was in Los Angeles with Chris Paul. He'd play alongside Chris Paul, and he would get decent minutes, and he was still able to adjust his game where he was able to get enough fantasy-relevant stats in that role. But they've got Ben McLemore, who's going to play the two. They've brought in Marco Bellinelli to play the two as well. So their whole backcourt situation is a little bit weird to me in terms of guys that the Collison-McLemore backcourt last year, I thought was doing well, and I thought they were progressing and they were learning and they were growing together. But then they bring in Bellinelli and Rondo, and it just throws lots of spanners into the works. How do you see this working for Collison? Is he going to be just like cut down to like a 20-minute a night guy? Does he play at the two? Does that mean McLemore loses out? How does it work out?
For me, the big question there is, if Collison is better than Rondo, will George Karl have the latitude to play him more? And I honestly don't know. I mean, I think that they made only a 1-year commitment to Rajon Rondo, but they paid him a bunch of money and they gave up a ton of assets to clear space, and he was the primary guy that they got with it. So I think that he's, as we've talked about before, he's going to get the benefit of the doubt. You know, he's going to get that opportunity. And Collison does play well next to ball dominant guys, but they have other guys that do that too. And you talked about McLemore and Bellinelli. That's definitely true. And they have Rudy Gay at the three. So it's not like you can keep sliding guys over, because eventually you're going to get to the firewall guy. Gay.
Danny is dropping out there at the moment.
If his value tanks, he might be a great guy to have for a flyer, because if Rondo gets hurt, which he has historically, then Collison's value skyrockets. Then he becomes a player who is incredibly valuable, because he's already has established chemistry with those players. And if you get Rondo out of the mix, there are a ton of point guard minutes and nobody else to fill him. So if you're in a league that has enough roster spots, he's a very interesting guy to have as a flyer, but that means that you shouldn't draft him high and you should be very skeptical. But it's kind of a name to think about, but your misgivings are completely spot on, because their rotation, the way it makes the most sense, excluding the whole Rondo issue, is with Collison playing a small role, and he doesn't deserve that. But at a certain point, what you deserve doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's he's fine to take in that last round, because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how they're going to run it, but there's going to be a stage where if he's getting less than 20 minutes a night, you're just not going to be able to afford to hold on. But you've got to keep an eagle eye out and watch what happens if Rondo goes down, or if he starts sucking, basically like what he did in Dallas. Then there is a chance that Collison gets in, and then his numbers just skyrocket, because overall, he's a better fantasy prospect than what Rondo is if they were playing equal minutes. In San Antonio, yeah. LaMarcus Aldridge joins the team. They lose a couple of guys, Thiago Splitter and Marco Bellinelli, but the addition of Aldridge probably has the biggest impact on guys, especially Tim Duncan, who is he's always underrated from a fantasy point of view, because everyone's always, I'm not playing Tim Duncan, he's not playing minutes, he's going to rest games. But Danny, he barely rested at all last year. Like, he played limited minutes, but my thing isn't, I've had this discussion with people and they go, oh, yeah, he hasn't played 30 minutes. I don't care if he doesn't play 30 minutes. If he goes out there and gets 15 points and 10 rebounds and 2 blocks in 25 minutes, then that's fine, because a lot of guys can't do that in 32 minutes. But he's gonna have the ability now to play even less minutes, and that's a little bit worrying for Duncan. And Kawhi Leonard, as a guy who is theoretically the future of this team, not even theoretically, he is the future of this team and really turned it on in the second half of last season. He's going to have another guy there who Aldridge likes to be the alpha guy, the main scorer. So that is going to impact both those guys, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. Offensively, Kawhi's going to get his role changed a lot. I mean, there was a stretch of last season where he got a ton of touches and he did pretty well with it. I mean, I think Kawhi as an overall player is the best guy on this team already. Like, I think this is Kawhi's, not emotionally Kawhi's team, but I think he's the guy in that sense. But that doesn't mean a whole lot in terms of this. And what scares me, I mean, I don't, like, with fantasy with the Spurs is, fantasy championships, if that's what you're going for, are decided late in the year, and that's when the Spurs are notorious for sitting guys. So if they're like, if I were sitting in a situation where it's like, okay, I need to, if at the, you know, in early April, and I'm sitting there and I say, oh, I need big games out of Kawhi Leonard, if they have their seed settled or even close to it, I don't think Popovich will just be like, okay, you're going to play 15, 18 minutes, and that's a killer. But during the course of the season, I think those guys are so talented that it can broadly work out. You're right about Duncan. I mean, Duncan, he's good enough to overcome the minutes limitation. I mean, it does curb his ceiling to a degree, because he's not going to play 35 minutes a game. But there is an intense value to reliability. And people talk about that in terms of the joke about him being boring and all that. But from a fantasy perspective, there is something really nice about being like, okay, I can sit this guy in there and he's going to get a couple blocks. He's going to do well in rebounding. He's also going to score at an efficient rate. And so he doesn't, I'm guessing his free, I haven't checked his free throw numbers in a little bit. I think those are still shaky, but other than that, he's a good guy for that. And to a point, it's nice to have some of those guys on your roster. Just the downside is you can't rely on him. So I think that should push him down, but still gives you value. If you know what you're getting out of him, he's a fine guy to have.
Yeah, look, last year he averaged 14 and 9. He had 2 blocks a game, almost a steal. He shot 51% from the field and 74% from the line. So they're fantastic numbers, and he did it in less than 29 minutes a game. Now he might drop 2 minutes a game. That's fine, but that's he still might get you 12 and 8 with 1.7 blocks, and the percentages and the efficiency will still be there. And there's still numbers where you can use him, and you can always get him at a discount in drafts because everybody is like, he's old, he's going to sit, he's going to not play minutes, he's got no ceiling. But that's fine. But there is a point in getting consistency and getting you look for upside at times, but at sometimes you want to, I just want a guy who's going to do what I know he's going to do, and that's exactly what Duncan is. Atlanta, in their big man rotation, Al Horford and Paul Millsap are pretty locked in, but they did acquire Tiago Splitter, who is a guy who I think is really underrated by a lot of people. He was a big key to San Antonio, and I think them losing him is going to have some impact, especially defensively. Now, he comes across to Atlanta. The issues with Mike Scott there, obviously, he's probably not going to be a big part of their team this year. So Splitter's going to get some minutes, but does he cut into Horford and Millsap at all, or does it impact Splitter in that he won't get as many minutes as he saw in San Antonio?
Splitter's probably the biggest loser because he's not the top guy on the depth chart at his position. But what I find fascinating is Budenholzer is a Popovich disciple, and Popovich loves, giving his starter some rest. But the Hawks last year were defined by their starting five. It was a great unit. They did really well. Those guys played a lot of minutes together. They stuck with them except for some weird foul trouble issues. Budenholzer now has the ability to play a guy in Splitter who is almost as good as those guys, but isn't a starter. So what makes Splitter a risk is was his philosophy based on the five he had, or was his philosophy based on he likes to play starters? And as a first time head coach, it's hard to, as a young head coach in terms of being in control of setting the rotation, we really don't know. And my instinct is that Splitter will play plenty, but plenty is not a ton. As you said, you can't really move Millsap to the three. So then what you're talking about is maybe more of a Cleveland style situation where these guys all play and they all play a fair amount and they're very successful, but they get less minutes than they were getting before. They get less touches than they were getting before. So I think Splitter is the most likely to lose, but I am completely open to the possibility of Budenholzer really limiting, I would say in some ways, Millsap, in the sense that I think Horford is going to really like playing with Splitter. And I think that cannot be discounted when Horford is going to be a free agent. So I think that you let him have those minutes of power forward. I think that, and that could hurt Horford's fantasy value too, because that when you play power forward, unless you're Serge Ibaka, you get less block opportunities, things like that. But that, I think that it makes it, that possibility makes Splitter intriguing. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of uncertainty there, but there's a lot of talent. And where you have talent, that's where I'm more willing to take a risk, because those guys are good. And and there's always the possibility of injury, and those guys can play, have all three of them can play a minute if desired.
Now, we're talking about the Hawks. Just had a question come in regarding the Hawks from Starks_industry, my man Tony Stark there. Do you believe Dennis Schroeder can cut into more playing time? Is he worth a flyer in a 12-team league? Well, down the stretch last year, Danny, he was playing 24, 25 minutes. Jeff Teague was having his minutes limited as well, and Teague saw a significant drop-off in the second half of last season. Do you see Schroeder being able to increase that next year, or is he going to go back to that 19, 20-minute sort of backup role?
I love Schroeder. I'm a big fan of his. But the challenge with those guys, with Schroeder and Teague, is you can't play. I don't think you can play them together too much. I mean, Budenholzer did it to his own detriment in the playoffs last year. So, I mean, if he's willing to do it, you can do it. But Schroeder is going to be a lot better. He's a guy who came into the league very young. He came into the league from a foreign country. I mean, he played against some good competition, but he hadn't done it a ton. So I think this is the year that he breaks out from a talent, from a per minute perspective, but there just might not be enough minutes for him to get. So I love the guy. I would say, yeah, I mean, if you want an upside play at that position, if you need a guy like that, you would probably tell better than I can in terms of from an efficiency perspective how he is. But I mean, I like him in terms of steals and just in terms of his defensive talent. I could see him as a player that Budenholzer just starts gravitating to in a way that is useful. But at the same time, I can't see him usurping Teague. That just seems too unlikely for a team that was so successful last year.
Yeah, I think Schroeder's going to have significant value for Dynasty Leagues in the next couple of seasons. I've said it for basically all of last season. He's going to be a guy in a similar mold to Eric Bledsoe who's going to play as a guy that, look, he's got talent, he's going to be a backup, but once he hits restricted free agency, he's going to go to a team and he's going to blow up pretty much straight away when he gets to that team. But it's going to be hard for him to do that in Atlanta. Always when we say this, it's always barring injury. We don't know what's going to happen in that sense. But Schroeder will at some stage have to get traded or get a massive deal from another team and he'll go somewhere else and then he'll get 30 minutes and then he'll go out there and put up big numbers. Now, efficiency-wise, he was really good. He struggled immensely as a rookie. He shot less than 40% from the field. He was up to 43 last year. He was 83% from the free throw line. In just 20 minutes a game, he was averaging 10 points a game and 4 assists. So you take that up to 30, and we're talking some bigger numbers. And then there's the growth involved in that as he gets more used to playing. And you know, the third year is when guys really start to kick it on. I find it's going to be hard for him to be a standard league 12-team guy, I think, this season. But it's always you keep an eye on, and if something happens to Teague. But it's more like investing in the future. In a couple of years, he could be easily a top 50 guy. Once he gets that role where he is designated as the starter and playing 30, 33 minutes a night. Now, Danny, maybe
we're on the same page.
Maybe you can help me with this because this is something that I've had trouble with and I've had some discussions with people about it. Chicago, their big men rotation. I don't know what's going to happen. We hear that they're not going to start Taj and Powell and Noah. We've heard that come out that they're thinking of not starting those two together. But I don't know how it works out. I don't know how the minutes go. I think Gasol has to get 30 minutes a night, but apart from that, I don't know what else happens. How do you see it breaking down?
I think Mirotić is going to get a chance, which I'm thrilled about. I think he was their best big man last year, which is crazy to say. I just love him. I like what he does with their offense because they can use him in a way to make their starting lineup, especially when Rose is a little bit more limited, to make them more potent. I think that Hoiberg is going to be a lot more open to him and what he can bring. But you're right. I mean, Powell played well enough that it's hard to see cutting his minutes. And if Noah, as most of us expect, that his rough season was largely due to injury, he's played such a huge role in the arc of that franchise that it's tough to imagine him, you know, getting that. What I find kind of frustrating to a point about the Bulls is that if they don't trade anybody, all of those guys are good and it might hurt all of their value.
Yep.
Because you can't, I mean, you're just sitting there in a situation where you're going to do that and they're going to be good. So those players are probably going to tolerate, you know, that kind of instability a little bit more, just like we saw with teams like the Warriors, because if you're winning, generally players don't complain a whole heck of a lot, but how they fit them, I think, is a very important thing. And I think that's true in terms of fantasy, too. I think we're going to see more of Mirotić and Noah and then Pau and Taj, because those are the lineups, the pairings that it pretty much always should have been. And Thibodeau was more reluctant to do that. I think Hoiberg is going to want more shooting. He's going to want more balance, and those lineups do well. But, yeah, my instinct is Taj is going to lose out a little bit just because he's the best fourth big man in the league by such a ludicrous margin, but he is still the fourth big man. And yeah. I think that he's better than that. I mean, I think he could start on a lot of teams, but from a fantasy perspective, that's the most likely. And when you think about it from a touch perspective, that's going to be the other challenge too, because who plays with who, you know, if Powell plays a lot with the second unit, you can use him as like the hub of the offense. And I think Powell is wonderful in that role. I love him in that role, but will he be happy in that? So maybe he starts. You're right. Their situation is brutally hard to figure out. But as we talked about with Atlanta, they're also good that it's hard to say, oh, you should pass on them or you should move down. Because if anything happens to clear up their rotation, all of those guys are awesome.
Yeah, like we've seen Noah being a top 20 guy. Gasol was a top 20 guy last year. When someone was injured last season, Mirotić was a top 30 sort of player. Taj Gibson's had value as an attached. Yeah, he's clearly the fourth guy there. But those other three guys are all guys where you go, I want these guys to play 32 to 35 minutes and put up big numbers, and they can. It's just not going to happen, really, in Chicago, unless injuries happen, and we know Noah's been prone to that. Gasol has been prior to last season as well. Gibson's had ankle surgery. He's not ready to take the court yet. So there is some injury concern there now, but it's definitely difficult to work out. Plus they drafted Bobby Portis, plus Doug McDermott played a lot of four in summer league as well. So there's just more guys that they can throw in. There's just so much.
And what's hard with them is when you're a really good team, it's hard to preemptively trade somebody. And so like I've said for a little bit that to me, the most logical guy for them to trade is Pau Gasol, just because Pau has value and he kind of doesn't fit as well with the other pieces they have. But I would never tell a team to trade him right now because we still don't know exactly what's happening with Joakim Noah. So what you could see with these guys is that the situation resolves itself later in the year, but that gets hard because you can move any of them too. I mean, if Hoiberg isn't as committed to Joakim Noah as the other guys, they should move him, because if they're not going to, you know, give him the money that he wants in free agency, then you get something for him and they could fill his minutes with somebody who's almost as good. But then you have the personality issues and you have everything else. So the Bulls situation is tough, but and you talked about Portis. Portis was awesome in summer league. He was one of the five most impressive players without any qualification, you know, without saying he wasn't one of the five best rookies. He wasn't one of the five best anything. He was just a monster out there, and in a way that he could contribute immediately. If he went to another team, I would love him and be like, hey, if you want to give him 18 minutes a game, throw him in there right now, I'd be happy to do that. But that's the Chicago. You can't do that.
Yeah, he's just not going to get anywhere near that sort of opportunity.
No.
A couple other big men I want to talk about, Danny, before we go. Alex Len in Phoenix. I'm a big Alex Len fan. I was really excited for him to have a breakout season until they signed Tyson Chandler. So Chandler's going to go in there. He's probably going to play 30 minutes. So that's going to limit Len. I don't really think that they can play together at all. So it's going to limit Len. We're talking about summer league. Len looked like a monster out there playing there. He just looked huge. He was able to do a lot of different things. And it's hard for big men to really dominate summer league, but he was quite good out there. I thought he looked really impressive. But it's going to really take a hit this year. I think he's going to be really hard for him to get over 20 minutes a night. What do you think
he's
on Len
in
for
a
his
tough
future?
Spot. Oh, I mean, because not only did they sign Tyson Chandler, they signed him for a bunch of money long term. And generally, when a team does that, when they have a young player at the same position, that's a vote of non-confidence in that young player, especially because you can't slide either of them. Yep. You can't play Tyson Chandler at the four. You can't play Alex Len at the four. So, yeah, I mean, I think that what that says two things. One, it says his minutes are going to be low and they're going to be low quickly. So that's a negative. And the second part, as I just said, is that that's showing that they don't have a ton of faith in him. And while you and I both liked him in summer league, I liked him last year too, that says something important. And he's in a tough spot, and the Suns are in a tough spot, because you can think about the idea of, oh, well, maybe they should trade him, in the sense of, you know, like, you know, if you're committing that much to somebody who directly overlaps with another player, you're just going to be kneecapping his value. But Tyson Chandler, you talked about injury concerns. He's their only other true center, at least that I can think of offhand. So you can't trade your backup. You can't trade your backup, especially if you still see potential in him, even if you love your starter, because you need that guy. So I think this is a real rough year for his fantasy value. I would love to be wrong. I really like Alex Len, but all the warning signs, like the red flags, are just in a line on him right now.
Yep, definitely. Myers Leonard in Portland. He was not only one of the best shooting big men in the league, he was the best shooting big man in the league last year, 50-40-90 season. And really in the playoffs, really started to come on. He was playing in preference to Robin Lopez. Lopez would start, play about 18 minutes, then Leonard would come off the bench and put in some pretty big minutes and big performances. And now you think, okay, LaMarcus Aldridge is gone, Lopez is gone. Maybe it's Leonard's job and he's going to play 30 minutes. But then they just bring in a whole bunch of guys. Mason Plumlee arrives. Ed Davis is there. Al-Farouq Aminu, who's probably going to play three, but he's probably more suited to play the four. Is Leonard likely to... The way I see it, I see Aminu at the three, Leonard at the four, Plumlee at the five. How do you see it? Do you think Ed Davis jumps over those guys?
It was funny. If you took their whole season, their whole offseason, and added in the Mason Plumlee part, it'd be like, okay, you know, it all fits together. You have all these pieces. But Plumlee, not that he's a bad player, but what he does is he garbles their rotation. Because Plumlee, you know, he was a member of the team, you know, say a FIBA team. He's successful. I think he's overrated as a player, but he is talented, and they gave up an assets to get him. So Yeah, I mean, maybe they do Leonard at the four, Plumlee at the five, but what I like about Leonard in fantasy is that I think he's still going to get his minutes. And while they still also have Chris Kaman, who you can't discount because he had some good stretches, and they chose to keep him, which is another thing that matters, is when you choose to keep a guy affirmationally, not only to retain his contract because they could have shed him easily, but they chose not to trade him, is that you do generally do that for a reason. I mean, part of it is that they have basically unlimited cap space, so it's not like it would have really helped them in that sense. But I think that what I like about Leonard is I think he'll get his minutes. And your hypothetical of him starting at the four is probably the best case scenario in terms of his fantasy value, because he'll get touches. I think that playing with Lillard is a very good thing for him. Though I love him playing against backup centers, just because backup centers are probably sitting there as he's standing out there at the three, just being like, put their hands up and just say, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to defend this guy. But I think that what makes it hard is that you see this possibility of, I always call it kind of the worst case scenario of Plumlee outplays him. Plumlee is the starter. Leonard can't really defend power forwards enough. And so then you start to slide him into that backup role. And while he'd still be efficient there, you're not getting the counting stats. You're not getting the value. I still like Leonard. I think that he's worth taking, but he's somebody who I wouldn't want to take him high. You know,
No.
like, so if you're in a league where people just aren't as into him as you and I are, then if you can get him at a reasonable value, this happens a lot in fantasy football too, where it's like, I like a guy less than some people, but more than most. And so if you can get him at a reasonable place, I think you do it, and you accept the risk that comes with it. But you don't want to be the person who takes him two rounds early, because that's just gonna it's just gonna sabotage yourself, because I just don't think he's gonna provide that surplus possibility.
Yep, exactly. Now, one guy I did want to talk about, not really, he's not, doesn't fit into the off-season loser category, Danny, and it's Justin Anderson. Man, we talked about guys we liked at Summer League, and towards the end of Summer League, he was just on a different level. He looked like a different guy from the first couple of games. Now, we know that they've got Chandler Parsons there at three. Wes Matthews is normally going to be there starting two, but we don't even know if either of these guys are going to be ready to start the season, or if Matthews is going to be playing in November, or if he's going to be playing in December. We don't know. Like, he tore his Achilles in March. Like, we don't know when Wes Matthews is going to be back. So that means there is minutes opening up there. Do you see them? Anderson impressed a lot in Summer League. Could he move into the starting lineup there, or do you think that they would put Devin Harris playing the minutes next to Darren Williams there? Did you like what you saw from Anderson, and how do you see that fitting in at the start of the season?
I liked him. I don't think I loved him in the way that you did, but he does have talent, and he also fits in with kind of where they're going. Because what you want, if you have Dirk Nowitzki, if you have Darren Williams, and presumably Zaza Pachulia is going to start, you want more of a guy who's just going to get his shots, who's not going to be ball dominant. And I think Justin Anderson fits that to a T. I think that Matthews and Parsons will probably both be playing at the beginning of the season. It's just an instinct, but that doesn't mean they'll be playing as much. And what I love about Rick Carlisle and why he's fun from this perspective is, if a guy plays well enough, play it. And if a guy doesn't, he'll sit him. That's what happened with Rajon Rondo. It's happened throughout his coaching career. And so I think that if Anderson, what it comes down to then is, do you think Anderson can play well enough to impress Carlisle to play it? And I think that's certainly possible. The dynamic with Dallas's, bench unit, particularly at the perimeter positions, is they have a ton of possibility, but they don't have a ton of guys that have established themselves, especially losing Richard Jefferson to Cleveland. Not that I'm high on Richard Jefferson at all, but I'm a guy who had played for Rick Carlisle before. So I think that Anderson will get that opportunity. I'm a little bit less sold than you are on him maximizing it, but that opportunity, really fun flyer guy, because what you not only do you get to root for his success, but his ceiling in terms of fantasy value is very high, because if he does well, he'll.
Yeah, look, the way I see Anderson is, I don't think he's going to have value for the whole season. I think he's going to be in a situation where maybe you draft him and you play him through November while those other guys are coming back, and then he'll go back to a very minimal role. But I think that he could be a guy that you take in your last pick. He might go out there and play 24 minutes, 25 minutes for a month, and then he goes off, and that's fine to take with your last pick. Then just
And
move on
he's
to someone
a
else.
great he's a great draft low, trade high guy. And those are people who fantasy, a lot of fantasy people don't like to think about that because you don't like draft. It's kind of like, you know, signing a guy to trade him in the real NBA. It's an uncomfortable thing for some people, but it's a great way to get surplus value. If you, you know, if he blows up for 2 weeks and you make somebody an offer that they shouldn't accept, but they do, that's perfect for you. You've gotten more out of Anderson than you ever should have.
And there's no time like the first week of the season where people overreact to people's value. So if he goes out there, starts the first couple of games and drops, you know, 20 points with three threes, and people get just crazy excited about what they see in the first two games of the season, and they start panicking, and that's the best time to pounce on someone who's a little bit overeager. Now, Danny, we're running short on time now, but I want you to answer a couple of quick questions for me on some new coaches. Just basically, does this mean an increase in numbers or a decrease? Fred Hoiberg in Chicago.
Okay. Yeah, increase offensively, so for most fantasy stats, and it'll change the rotation a little bit. I think it's more advantageous for the stretch bigs, Mirotić and Portis, potentially, if they ever clear it out. But yeah, I think offensively is going to help them a lot.
Now, this one to me is pretty much a no-brainer, but Elvin Gentry in New Orleans.
Oh, man, it's going to be awesome. I mean, that it totally changes. Eric Gordon, I think, helped a lot. Anthony Davis. It's hard to conceive of Anthony Davis being a substantially better fantasy player than he was, but I think it's going to help all those guys except for maybe Oshik, because Oshik is pretty much himself. But yeah, I think Gentry is going to be—he'll be huge for them. The question for New Orleans is who stays healthy. You know, whoever stays healthy is going to have a lot of fantasy value for them. But that's been a huge question for the last 3 years.
Fingers crossed for Jrue Holiday. Now, yeah. Billy Donovan in Oklahoma City.
I think he's going to help a lot of their players, and it's not just that their offense has been way too static, but I think that one of the major dynamics he's going to do is there's going to be a much greater staggering of Westbrook and Durant. And I think that while that hurts their overall team efficiency to a point, because I love those two guys and I think they're good together, it helps both of them from a fantasy perspective because they get more time to be a man. And I think that helps them a lot. I think they're going to – Donovan, his offensive scheme should work well with their talent. So, yeah, I think it'll be better. There will be certain guys that lose out. I always think about guys who get minutes and you're never exactly sure why, like Nick Collison. Like a guy like Nick Collison might lose out. But he's not super high-end on the fantasy. You're thinking more about the guys. Also, I wonder about Gators in the sense of – he has so much offensive potential, but he also can drive coaches crazy. So will Donovan have a shorter leash on him than Brooks did because they gave up a first-round pick for him?
Last one is Mike Malone in Denver, replacing the always humorous Brian Shaw.
He'll be better. I mean, I still wish they'd hired D'Antoni, especially from a fantasy perspective. Well, yeah. But Malone, his willingness to play up tempo, I've heard a little bit about that now, is I mean, I think more as a defensive tactician, as a guy like Thibodeau who likes that as a part of defensive identity. And if he can do that combination, that would be a dream for all those guys' value. I mean, you think of a guy like Gallinari, Wilson Chandler, Moutier, Moutier to me was the most impressive player at the league, but young guards almost always struggle. So from a fantasy perspective, that's going to be there. The upside is he's going to have minutes and he's going to be awesome. But I think that Malone could really help those guys. I think he could help Nurkic. I think they have an understanding now that they have something special in him. And so I'm excited about basically all of their guys. But when that's actually a little bit of a warning sign. When you're excited about everybody, that means you should probably be less excited about everybody.
Yeah, because somebody's gonna lose out.
Exactly.
We don't know who it's going to be, but somebody is going to lose out. All right, Danny, that brings us to the end of today's show. It was great having you on. Now, where can everyone find you on Twitter again? Give them a reminder.
Sure, I'm at Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux.
And make sure you are listening to Danny's podcast. So it's Real GM Radio, and he's also a frequent contributor on the Dunked On podcast with Nate Duncan. So subscribe to both of those through iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you are listening to your podcast, and leave a review, and do the same for this podcast as well. Leave us a review on iTunes and also subscribe. And welcome also, I should have said this at the start, welcome if you are listening across on the Hardwood Paroxysm Network, which the podcast is now a part of. So thank you for everybody who has been listening on that one. Danny, it's been great having you on. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. A pleasure. Good to see you again.
You too. No worries, everyone. That's it. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.